My name is Joyce Otten, and the title of this session is Common Myths About Death. In 1978, on a very lovely, warm summer day in August, we were preparing to go on vacation, and I went to the store that morning and bought groceries for the son we were going to leave at home. He was going to be working while we were vacationing. That afternoon, we got a telephone call from the hospital. He had been involved in an auto accident, and although we were there before he died, we never had an opportunity to talk to him. He died in that hospital very suddenly. He was 2 weeks away from his 18th birthday, 3 weeks, I guess, and 2 weeks away from the time that he would have left home to go to college. That left us as a family with a lot of grief work to do. And it left me with a lot of thinking that I have done since that time, not only over that issue, but over other issues. So that, I think, explains somewhat my interest in this subject. One of the things that was said to me almost immediately at the time of Tom's death was one of the myths that's on this sheet of paper that I handed out to you. And that is, it's God's will. I'm glad to hear you say that. So did I. I did not appreciate that at all. And my response was, no, I don't think God wanted this any more than I do. I think God is crying with me. If you turn the page over that you have have in your hand, number 9, some implications of that are that God causes everything, from birth defects to hemorrhoids. You would have to then avoid all responsibility in your life, because after all, everything that happens is God's will. And yet the idea that death is God's will is one which permeates our society, as do many of these others. If you look at the front page, you will see that the myths listed on this sheet come from an article which was written by Reverend Charles Meyer. He is a hospital chaplain. It was published in The Witness, which is an Episcopalian publication, in March of 87. When I knew I was coming here, I called for reprints of the article because I thought that would be a good thing to share with you. There are no reprints of the article because the author has since written this book, which is called Surviving Death, in which he expands on his article. And I would like to recommend this book to you. It's not available in the bookstore, I don't think. I did not recommend it to the bookstore because I didn't know of its existence at the time I sent in a book list. But I do find that it's a very helpful book. It's called A Practical Guide to Caring for the Dying and Bereaved. There's a lot more than that in that book, and it does answer some of the things that you've seen on this paper. The first myth on here, and let me say this, myth is often used in a very good and positive sense, is a story that gives meaning to our lives. In this sheet, we are, primarily dealing with those things which are, we need to take a better look at. They are probably all false. You may not agree. If you do not agree, you ought to feel free to say so and to explain that, and I'm going to give you an opportunity for that. The only old people die myth is one that, of course, when our son died, was immediately blasted. Do we believe that? Intellectually, we'd probably say, no, we don't believe that. We know younger people die. We know babies are stillborn. We know children die. We know teens die. But we don't really believe that. And let me explain what I see as the difference there between knowing that and believing it. Believing it means that when it happens to you, you can say with confidence, yes, I know that this is what happens. And yet when a young person dies, when someone who is not old dies, or even when that young person is very ill. We cannot believe in this possibility that life is ending so quickly. Life shouldn't end at age 17, or 4, or 32. I presently work with people with AIDS, most of whom are young people. That's one of the devastating things about the AIDS epidemic, if you will, is that it strikes young people who are not supposed to die. That's opposite to the myth. Some of the implications that Meyer sees for these of the only old people die myth is that extraordinary efforts should always be taken to preserve the life of the young, and that it's okay for old people to die, that those same efforts should not be taken. Hospital chaplain told me one time, we spend hundreds and thousands of dollars to preserve the life of the baby who is born weighing only 1 pound and who will probably never live a normal life. But I can't get a crutch for one of my older people when he leaves the hospital. Now that's an implication of the myth. Our myths determine how we live. And so it's a good thing to look at some of our myths and wonder whether maybe we should be doing something differently. The second one on the list, medical science can cure everything. And in fact, if it doesn't, perhaps we ought to sue the doctor or the hospital or someone else, because no one really ought to die. There should be, according to our myth, some way to keep every single person alive. And something is wrong when they do die. It is or soon will be possible to cheat death. Well, of course, our intellect says no. But when we're speaking about ourselves in particular, or those who are very close to us, we often live as if that myth is true. Life is always the highest value. I think our society really does act as if life itself, biological life, is the highest value. As long as we can keep someone breathing and functioning in some way, that is the highest good. Yet some of Meyer's implications for that are that life must always be preserved at any cost. Keep people on respirators so long as you possibly can. Death is never, then, an acceptable outcome for our loved ones or for ourselves. And yet I'm sorry, but welcome to Earth. The death rate here is 100%. None of us gets out of this alive. And yet we haven't really faced that reality very often. Money should not be a consideration when life is at stake. That's a myth, because money is always a consideration when life is at stake in the medical community. There are just so many dollars to go around. And believe it or not, that's always something that is to be considered. Today, for someone with AIDS, for instance, the drug costs approximately $700 a month, the drug called AZT, which is not a cure for AIDS, but one which has proven to be somewhat effective in keeping people alive longer. Well, if you multiply that by the hundreds of thousands of people who are expected to be victims of AIDS, or I shouldn't have used the term victims, but who are involved with the disease, that's a fantastic amount of money. Dialysis is a very expensive thing. Transplants are very expensive. Money is always a consideration. So whether it should or should not be, it is. The death is evil. Death is always bad. Good is always rewarded then by prolonged life. Evil is punished by death. So what is the thing that we often think of when people become ill or are dying? What's wrong? What have they done? that transfers well into the AIDS epidemic as well. It is very easy for people to say, let's don't lay out money for those people because they probably did something to bring this on themselves. And that's why they have AIDS. And one young person who has AIDS had an aunt tell him that. And he said to her, you had a mastectomy a couple years ago. What did you do? And so again, we need to take a look at that. Is death always the result of a specific thing that we have done? Many people believe that. Or death means failure. Either I have failed as an individual or the health community has failed in taking care of me. Many doctors strongly believe that death means failure. They cannot allow a person to die in peace. They must do everything they possibly can to prolong life biologically. Where there's life, there's hope. And again, this emphasizes biological activity as a source of hope, but optimism about living and hope are not synonymous. Or that suffering is redemptive. Don't take pills that ease your pain, because God wants us all to suffer, and therefore these are not things we ought to be doing. That is sometimes people's attitude towards dying painfully. You don't die till your number comes up. You don't want to then be on the plane with the pilot whose number comes up. This is, again, God is the source or the cause of death, the God who personally decides the time of death for each individual. That's unfortunately something that's taught in the church. I didn't bring it down, it's upstairs, I think. I have a book that's published for children. It's a well-known author, and it's published by the church, and it has sold into the millions of copies. And it's called A Time to Live, A Time to Die. And one of the pages in there for little children says, God will decide when you should die. Now, that gives no one a chance except to sit around and wait for that moment when God is going to zap them. Okay? It is God's will. Or then, we've talked about that, number 10, living wills and or pulling the plug are the same as suicide or murder because they are attempts to take life into our own hands. People who write living wills and ask that their life not be preserved unnecessarily by machinery and what have you, many people dislike that a great deal because they say, well, then you're trying to dictate to God when you should die. You're trying to do something about it yourself. So they kind of go together. With that introduction, and that's just some explanation here of the myths that Meyer describes as those which permeate our society, I think it's far more important for you to talk about those than it is for me to talk about them. Each of you probably has a story that one of these impacted in some way or another. You may have made a choice somewhere along the line because you believed one of these things. Or someone else in your life may have made a choice because they believed one of these things. Or someone may have hurt you a great deal by saying one of these things. And it's important for us to take a look at how these myths have impacted our own lives. And that's better if you do that than if I do that. So I'd like to suggest that you do that in groups of about four, and preferably choose three other people you don't know really well, and that give you an opportunity not only to get acquainted with some other people, but perhaps to talk more freely initially than you would with some friends. So perhaps the first thing to do is to find a partner. Why don't each of you choose one partner and choose that from a person you don't know very well? And then the partners can team up and make a group of four. card. Yes, choose a partner, and then the two of you point in the set time there are four. Does anybody need help forming your group? If we got four people up there? Does anybody need a fourth person for their group? Or a third and fourth? Use one more here. Are there any groups that have more than four? We need somebody over here. Looks like I'll have to join you too. So that, may I have your attention for just a minute? So there's a little confusion about what the assignment is. The assignment is to take any of these myths and any that you think you have believed or you think someone else believed and talk about them and talk about your feeling. Maybe you agree with them and you have a right to say that. If you do agree with them and you do want to do that, then tell the other person why. Maybe something happened in your life that you want to further explore one of these with your group. In short, anything that's on here, you're free to talk about with your group. Does that help? Okay. In fact, it doesn't have to be on here. If it's a myth that has bothered you, go ahead and bring it up. Okay, I think we're all kind of back together again here. I hope you all had some good discussions in your group and were able to hear some points of view from other people. Perhaps you heard something that gave you something to think about, even though you may not presently agree with it. Perhaps you were able to share something from your life that has value for someone else. It's my contention that it isn't so much the planned things that we do through which God works as the unexpected things, the things that happen when people start talking to each other. And I would encourage you to talk about things like this, perhaps outside the group. We have really not a lot of time here, and you may wish to talk to other people and see how other people think and feel. For now, let's take a look at a different set of guidelines, and those guidelines again come from Dr. Charles Meyer, just as the myths are just his and can be expanded on, so are these guidelines. But these guidelines deal primarily with people who have the opportunity to do something. For instance, number one, to aggressively seek information. Good facts help make better choices. Very often, we permit ourselves to be at the mercy of the medical community. The doctor said we should do this. We're supposed to do that. I have no choice. You always have a choice. And doctors are not God. The medical community is a blessing to us, but doctors and medical science is not an exact science. And sometimes you discover that when you get a second opinion and a third opinion, the doctors do not even agree with each other. You have a right to make choices. Get information and make choices. Aim for a balance between the wants and needs of the patient and those of the family, while remembering the larger community. And oh, that sounds so simple, but oh, is that a tough order. There's never only one person involved. There are always many people involved. And we, on the one hand, want to honor the choices of the person who is dying. But there are times when there are so many other factors involved that we need to bring those into play as well. Consider the ethic of love and the ethic of need. What is the most loving thing to do in this situation? Another impossible question. because love acts in many different ways. But if we at least give the question some consideration, not just allow things to take their course and be caught up in the flow, but think about what is a loving way to deal in this situation. We are now here dealing, of course, with a terminally ill patient. And what are the real needs? Number four, remember that CAM does not imply ought. The medical community can do many, many things. Does that mean they always should do them, or we should always subject ourselves to them? Not necessarily. There are many factors here involved. I think there's enough time. I'll tell the rest of you about a choice I made for myself. 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, in May of 1987, I went to church on a Sunday morning and woke up in a hospital 3 weeks later. I went to church, as far as I was concerned, a perfectly healthy person, and I had a cardiac arrest during the service. I was very blessed with a lot of very rapid medical care, but I was out without a heartbeat of my own for 15 to 20 minutes. I shouldn't be standing here telling you this. Why did I live? I don't know the answer to that. But I lived, and I'm a functioning human being. And I forgot to tell you right at the beginning about my voice. And I usually try to do that. It doesn't hurt me to talk. I do have a partially paralyzed vocal cord, which is the result of that cardiac arrest in 87. I wondered for a while whether I would ever be talking again. So even the fact that I can talk to all of you without using a mic is a tremendous blessing. But after that event, and there were a whole series of events I won't go into, I was finally faced with a choice for myself. It seems that what caused my cardiac arrest was not a bad heart in the sense of having clogged arteries or a valve that didn't work properly, but an electrical short circuit. And there's an impulse which keeps the heart functioning properly. And there are always in the heart other electrical impulses. Once in a while, as in my case, one of these electrical impulses overpowers the other one. And when that happens, the heart just says, I don't know what to do, and it begins to fibrillate and quit. The fact that that happened to me once means that it's possible that it can happen to me again. So now the doctors were all concerned to do something so that this would not happen to me again. Well, they have two options. The first one I found out about in a hospital, and that one was that to have a defibrillator implanted. This requires major surgery, requires attaching electrodes to the heart, and having a generator implanted in your abdomen. It has its own share of problems. One of its many problems is that it cannot tell the difference between something called ventricular tachycardia and supraventricular tachycardia. Supraventricular tachycardia is not going to kill you. But if the generator goes off when you're having supraventricular tachycardia, that can kill you. So now you have a different choice. The doctor was sure, however, that this would be very worthwhile for me and I should do this. And I said I thought I'd go home and think about it. And he said, I couldn't let you do that because you might die before you came back. And I said, look, I'll come back tomorrow. And he said, tomorrow may be too late. So I went home. And I did some studying of the subject. That's the one about getting the facts yourself. And I saw some other doctors. Another doctor I saw along the way thought there's a drug that would be very helpful for me. It's a drug called amiodarone. I had by that time done a lot of reading about my particular problem, and I knew that amiodarone was a very dangerous drug. And I said so, and he said, well, yes, it does have a few problems, but I think I would like to err in that direction rather than in the direction of allowing you to go on without it. So I said, well, I'll think about that. And I went and found a physician's desk register directory, and read that about amiodarone, and I learned that if I took the drug that I might, possibly end up with damaged central nervous system, damaged gastrointestinal system, damaged kidneys, damaged liver, damaged spleen, and damaged eyes, but my heart would be fine. And I thought I would opt for going the route that I was going. Now, I'm not saying that the defibrillator or the drug is wrong for everybody. The defibrillator and the drug is right for a lot of people, but it was not right for me, and therefore it was the choice that I made. We are often faced with choices like this for which there are not easy answers. I cannot tell you that I made a right choice. I'm telling you I made a choice. And I made that choice believing and trusting that the God who loves and cares for me will continue to love and care for me with my choice. Does that mean he's going to keep me alive forever? No, I doubt that very much. But he's going to continue to love and care for me. Can does not always imply ought. Be there, and that's for the person who is terminally ill. Continuity and support are vital. I thank God for my family, one of whom is sitting in the back there, who gave me a great deal of support with my decision. Because, you see, I wasn't the only one involved in my decision. I have a family who cares about me. And it was a very hard choice for me to say, do nothing. Because the do something bit always seems to be the route you ought to go. Well, you could do this or you could do that. But for me, the better route was to say, do nothing. But then I wondered, well, now what will my family think if I died tomorrow, when I could have possibly saved my life by going this route or that route? Thank God for a loving, supportive family who encouraged me to make the choice, and knowing that I was the kind of person who would not live well otherwise. So I'm grateful for them. Look for what is right for this person. What is medically or legally right may not be ethically right. Begin to see death as a form of healing. Oh, this is a hard one. We as Christians say we believe that death is victory. We look forward to the life to come. And yet, we as Christians also are very human beings who would like to preserve life at any cost and do really hang in there and do not really see death as a form of healing. When our son was dying in the hospital, it was another pastor and his wife who were there with us, and we had joined hands to pray for his healing. And I want to believe that that prayer was answered. Tom died, but I do believe that God gave us the gift of his healing in a way which I do not fully understand, because I do not fully understand what life after death is all about. But if I do indeed believe in a God of mercy and a God of all grace and a God who loves and cares, then I believe he hears and gives his healing when we ask for it. Then indeed we do need to see death as a form of healing. It can often be a logical, even welcome alternative to a debilitating life. We can begin to see the Bible as a mirror for identity rather than as a rule book to tell us what to do. Sometimes I think we try to find answers for our dilemmas in the Bible. And I think what we need instead to discover is that the Bible tells us who we are and gives us the ability to know something about God and something about his great love for us in all of the situations of our lives. Then we can use the information we gather about ourselves as God's people as we make ethical decisions, most of which are very difficult. There aren't easy answers to many of these complex questions in life. We ought to also examine our own preparations for death, including such things as legal wills. Amazing how many people live to be 70, 80, and even into their 90s and never have made a legal will. They never really have come to grips with the idea that they will die. A durable power of attorney, because we will not always be functioning individuals, and we may live long past the time that we can make good and wise choices ourselves. making a living will, so that at least whether or not the living will is honored in our state, those who love us and care about us know what is our wish. Making our own funeral arrangements. Oh my, what a difficult thing to do. Morbid, some people would say. But is it better to leave all of that to our survivors who are grieving and sorrowing? Might it not be more helpful to them if we made some of these choices ourselves? Decisions regarding organ donation or registration with an organ bank. And finally, the first nine are all from Myers' book. The 10th one I put in. That's why I marked it with a little J. Ask the Spirit to shatter our false concepts of life, death, God, and ourselves, and to teach, restore, and renew us daily in the divine presence. I think that when we do that, and we learn to live our faith, as somebody in our group said before about a Mennonite hospital, nursing home, I don't know which, I remember he said, these people live their faith. And that's what I think is so important for us all, to live our faith. And to live our faith is to confront our death and to be more willing to talk about it and to let our concepts begin to change even just a little. And I thank you all for being here this afternoon.